and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station right around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
The power to be generated will be exported to Bangladesh.
Whilst FIFO workers continue to expand the Carmichael mine in Queensland, The Wire has found that a new coal-fired power station that Adani is building in Godda, near West Bengal, is actually going to be sending much of that power over the border to Bangladesh, adding more complexity to the Adani story. Also on the program...
So we've unfortunately had blood-sucking insects for a very long time in Australia, but we also have the social ants, we have a lot of long-legged and short-legged flies, and there's... I could keep going on, but I think I'd be here all day.
A new discovery of amber in Australia and New Zealand has given up an extraordinary amount of fossilised plants and animals from the time of Gondwanaland, way back in the Triassic times. This is quite significant, as we haven't had amber fossils in Australia before. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, today Australia has 5,788 confirmed coronavirus cases and 39 deaths. The good news is that there's some indication that the curve is flattening a little. The not-so-good news is that this could simply be a function of reduced numbers of people coming into Australia from overseas. We take a look at what it's like inside Australia's testing centres. We find it's no picnic for those who are being tested, nor the overworked medical staff there. Karishma Luthria has more.
As Australia sets up mobile testing centres, extends statewide lockdowns and social distancing measures, citizens are getting tested for coronavirus daily. But what is it really like inside one of these testing centres and hospitals? Sappho is a university student in Sydney, and when she was feeling sick, she self-isolated for a week before going into her nearest hospital.
So the first day when I went in, I was lucky that I didn't need to wait very long to be tested from when I arrived to when they actually did the swab. It was probably like maybe 10 minutes. Like it didn't take very long. I didn't have to do much waiting for that part.
Hospitals and their staff are overworked, low on supplies and protective gear, and in this case are also low on food and water. Sappho had to wait 11 hours before getting to drink a sip of water at a Sydney testing centre.
There was a tap, but there were no cups. So I presented at about midday and I got food at maybe 11 p.m, I want to say. And I hadn't had breakfast before I came here either, because I had been on the phone with my own GP in the mornings. In the end, I sort of was like to the nurse, I really haven't eaten. Can you please try and get me some food? I know it's really hard. And they did manage to get me some food and a little juice thing, which I refilled for water. But I didn't want to put pressure on them because, you know, they really need to reserve the equipment, and every time somebody left to go and get something, they had to fully discard everything they were wearing and get a new set of equipment. And once I was on the ward, there was meals three times a day.
But not only are hospitals low on supplies, they're also looking to recruit more doctors and nurses. Earlier this week, state governments in Victoria and New South Wales announced that both domestic and international students were offered the opportunity to help out during these trying times. Nathan is an intern at a rural New South Wales hospital who agreed to volunteer and says it was his duty to sign up.
At the end of the day, this is what we've signed up for. We have signed up to be in this profession where we can help out. And if we do have the ability to help out, there is a shortage of resources and we are capable of helping out. I think that we should all be stepping forward to help in any way we can.
While there have been concerns if these students are ready for such responsibility during the coronavirus pandemic, Nathan, a final year medical student and intern in rural New South Wales, believes they are.
At this stage, they've asked us to give us expression of interests, whether or not we'd like to help out. And we're also given information on in what capacity we would be involved as students. So at this stage, it would be just taking bloods, putting in cannulas and doing fluid shots, which we've all been trained to do as medical students already. We'd have to think of it as taking the load off doctors so they can focus their time to treat COVID patients rather than us in the hospital actually managing COVID patients ourselves. We've been told that we're going to be doing adequate training before we actually take those roles.
Hospitals are also taking every precaution they can to ensure their staff are protected. Here's Nathan, student doctor who agreed to volunteer at his hospital during COVID-19.
In our hospital, the emergency department has been separated into a hot zone and a cold zone. So the hot zone is where people are coming in with any type of respiratory symptoms. So entrance itself, they're separated so that there is a reduced risk for people who don't have coronavirus. When we started on our first day, we noticed how there was not many patients at all, because most of the patients were doing telehealth. So the hospital was very quiet. And I think that was a bit of a jarring thing. Felt like a weird calm before the storm. Those foam hand hygiene stations located like every 25 to 50 metres wherever you walk in the hospital.
Through this whole process, Sappho, who went to get tested at a Sydney hospital, believed that the staff were doing their best and were very supportive despite initial hiccups.
It would usually be the doctors or the nurses, if they needed to check up on me or wanted to ask me some questions, they'd call in on the phone. All the nurses that I had were lovely. They sort of knew that we were in isolation and probably a bit lonely, so when they came in to bring us our meals, they'd have a conversation with us, just chat to us, so we weren't like completely cut off from all human interaction. In the end, the doctor came in without any of the protective gear on and said, "Guess what I'm in here for?" And I was like, "You're not wearing the gear." And he was like, "That's right, you're negative." And I was like, "Woohoo!" I was so excited.
And while most people have been thanking doctors and medical staff for putting their lives at risk, Nithin, final year medical student and volunteer, believes people are at the front line.
The phrase that the hospitals are the front line is something that's getting thrown around a lot, but it's the people who are the front line. Social distancing is the front line. The doctors are the last resort to prevent this disease.
If you are feeling symptoms of COVID-19, such as a sore throat or a cough, it is advised to self-isolate and to contact the National Coronavirus Health Information Hotline on 1-800-020-080. If you are having breathing difficulties, call 000.
Karishma Luthria there, ending that report. In the past week, new legislation has given police across the states powers to make sure that people stay at home. Under these legislations, Australians face on-the-spot fines for leaving the house unless they have an acceptable reason, such as grocery shopping or exercising or visiting a medical practitioner. But how are these discretionary powers enforced by police, and are certain communities more at risk than others? Toby Hemmings has the story.
Drastic times call for drastic measures. Last week, state parliaments passed legislation restricting individual freedom of movement in order to slow the rate of infection of COVID-19. The message has been clear and simple. Stay at home. For Terry Goldsworthy, Associate Professor at Bond University, this is a balancing act.
This comes down to the balancing act that we have in our criminal justice system, where you have individual autonomy on one side and community welfare on the other. It's difficult. It's difficult for the police in enforcing these, and it's difficult for the public when they look at the kind of expectations that have been placed upon us in terms of self-isolation and restriction of our usual liberties. But you know, you've got to weigh that up against the risks that we face in the current climate.
Luke McNamara, Professor and Co-Director of the Centre for Crime, Law and Justice at UNSW. This is an unprecedented situation.
What's exceptional, I guess, about this situation is that we have a situation where people are legally required to stay at home, face certain circumstances, where the nature of the risk they present to the world is not related to criminality. And so this is what's, I guess, really interesting about this set of restrictions, is that they use restrictions on where you can be and who you can be with. And these things are quite familiar techniques in our justice system, where we're managing people who are deemed to be at risk of criminal offending. But here they're being used for a rather different purpose, entirely different purpose, actually. They're being used in relation to all of us, and they're being used to manage a public health risk.
The vast powers that police have been given are largely operated at their discretion. Luke McNamara explains how police should wield this power at this time.
For these regimes to work and to be perceived as legitimate by the community, then it really is critical that the police exercise their discretion. I'd be really concerned if we saw a pattern over the next weeks and months of large numbers of fines being issued or charges being laid. Criminal law does its best work as a regulatory tool when it's not being enforced harshly. So I think it's really important that we encourage the police in this context to use the criminal law and the powers that they have for educated purposes. It's really important that police officers exercise their discretion carefully and recognise that in many situations, I think a conversation with a person or a small group of people, education, warning, they'll be more appropriate modes of policing than whacking someone with an on-the-spot fine.
The issue of discretion arises due to how the legislation is drafted. People across Victoria, Queensland and New South Wales who contravene regulations face on-the-spot fines of over $1,000. Luke McNamara explains what dangers this presents.
There's no formal requirement under the COVID-19 Public Health Order 2020 that police issue a warning first. I think that's problematic. I think as a matter of good practice, it would be appropriate for police to not just occasionally but routinely issue warnings in the first instance, because we don't want a situation where people, out of ignorance perhaps sometimes, face with a situation where they're not complying with the order and they suddenly find themselves in receipt of $1,000 fines, for example, on the spot. For many people, that would be an enormous financial impost, and there's nothing about these fines which takes account of your capacity to pay, and so there really is scope for unevenness and unfairness.
In New South Wales, the relevant legislation will be in operation for a three-month period. However, members of the National Cabinet have been using a six-month timeframe to describe this situation. As the situation drags on, Luke McNamara believes that these regulations will have to shift.
The longer the period runs when we are subject to those restrictions, I think the harder it will be to retain the confidence of the community that the restrictions are necessary. Ultimately, it's important that governments continue to do what they're doing and match restrictions with the risk profile. So if the risk over time, as we hope it does, reduces, I think it's reasonable to expect that the restrictions on our liberty will reduce as well.
Recent data suggests that the curve has begun to flatten as people stay home. But until there is a vaccine widely available, there is no immunity guaranteed. For Terry Goldsworthy, this requires the community to pull together and abide by these restrictions.
You know, we really can't make exceptions. We've got to treat this as a blanket kind of rule so that we don't have examples of what occurred at Bondi Beach, et cetera, so and down at St Kilda. Common sense needs to prevail. And, you know, we're all in this together. No one in society is immune to the virus. It's a great leveller. And I think that we all need to pull together on it.
Terry Goldsworthy, Associate Professor at Bond University, ending that report from Toby Hemmings. COVID-19 restrictions are having a dramatic effect on economic activity and unemployment figures are growing by the day. However, there are many exemptions to the enforced closures of businesses and work sites. This includes essential services like health and food. Both state and federal legislation permits the construction of mining industries to operate, and fly-in, fly-out workers are exempted from interstate travel bans. The Adani Company is still working on the Carmichael mine site in Queensland and is also involved in controversial actions in a rural part of India. Rob Osborne has the story.
In August last year, the Queensland government extinguished native title over 1,385 hectares of Wangan and Jagalingu country. In doing this, they made the traditional owners effectively trespassers on their own land. To find out what is happening now, I spoke to Murawar Johnson from the Wangan and Jagalingu Family Council.
Every time we've gone up to country, we've visited the springs or we've had people go out to check on what's actually happening on the ground. There's been work going on, fencing and whatnot, some clearing here and there. And obviously we know that last year they were doing some illegal drilling.
There is also concern about the potential for COVID-19 to be spread amongst local communities.
The way that they get their workers out to the mine sites is planes and buses. These are hotbeds for the transmission of coronavirus. Also, Adani say that they employ a lot of Aboriginal people. They're still asking, you know, their Indigenous workers as well to come in and essentially put their families and their communities at risk.
With work proceeding on the Carmichael site, what is the overall strategy of the Adani company? I put that question to Jeff Law, the coordinator of Adani Watch for the Bob Brown Foundation. Jeff has just returned from a fact-finding mission to India.
At first glance, it must appear that Adani's business strategy with respect to its Australian coal is rather strange and perplexing, because they propose to transport the coal 10,000 kilometres from Queensland to a power station currently under construction in India. But the critical component from Adani's point of view is that the power to be generated will be exported to Bangladesh. And that has enabled them to escape what would otherwise be some very compelling economic realities in India. The fact, for example, that power from renewable sources such as solar in India is undercutting power generated from coal, and the fact that they have managed to wangle themselves a special economic zone for the power station under construction means that they will be exempted from a range of customs duties, local taxes, local regulations, potential political actions by the local government, and so on.
The site for the new coal-fired power station is about 300 kilometres north of Calcutta and about 500 kilometres from the nearest port. Jeff Law spent 2 weeks in the area and met with villagers and lawyers who are opposing Adani's actions in the region. I asked him to describe the situation he found there.
The area around Godda, the area where the power station is being constructed, is primarily a sort of rural agrarian kind of economy, peopled by the Adivasi, which means indigenous folk, the traditional farmers in the area who do lots of sharecropping, producing various crops such as rice, vegetables, mangoes, etc. On top of that, there's a more recent overlay, which is a whole series of major coal mines. Some of these are massive. They are just devouring entire landscapes and changing the complete feel and realities of the local economies.
Local people are complaining about the environmental degradation caused by 24-hour construction work, particularly the dust which smothers their crops. They are also angry about the legal and political tactics employed by Adani. Jeff Law again.
The land has been acquired from local villagers under a special piece of legislation. And this is very, very controversial from a legal point of view, as well as raising a whole host of humanitarian and human rights issues. The land has been forcibly acquired from many of the villagers who have said that they will not accept compensation, that the compensation that has been offered is inadequate, that they do not want to leave their traditional lifestyle, that the land which they've been farming for generations and which has been in their families for generations is very, very fertile, and that they have a great sense of connection to that land and to their local culture. In addition, the land was acquired on the basis that it was for a public purpose, that the construction of a power station there would be of great benefit to Indians generally. But that premise has been challenged in the courts and challenged in the public arena by the people affected, by the people whose land has been taken away, because they point out quite rightly that the power is to be exported to Bangladesh. So therefore, for the people in India, there is no public purpose. There is simply a huge profit for Adani.
Jeff Law, coordinator of Adani Watch for the B.B. Brown Foundation, ending that report from Rob Osborne. Have you ever wondered what roamed around Australia when it was still part of the ancient Southern Hemisphere supercontinent Gondwana? If so, you're in luck. Late last week, scientists from Monash University revealed the details of a historic haul of amber fossils, which takes us to a time as far back as 230 million years ago. Lachlan McPherson takes us into the lab at Monash University as paleontologists chip out the huge haul of amber embedded in coal.
Inclusions in amber, or plants and animals preserved in ancient fossilised tree resin, have been uncovered all over the world. But nothing much has ever been found in Australia or New Zealand. That is, until now. Published in Nature Research Journal Scientific Reports, a paper written by a team of scientists from Melbourne shares details of a six-year project that has seen almost 6,000 pieces of amber collected from 9 different sites across 2 countries. It's titled Amber from the Triassic to Paleogene of Australia and New Zealand as Exceptional Preservation of Poorly Known Terrestrial Ecosystems. And its lead author, Associate Professor Geoffrey Stilwell, says that these remarkable relics not only give us snapshots of ancient terrestrial ecosystems, but also show the antiquity of modern life on Earth.
There's a lot to it, but what's really important about amber is that you're basically looking into a window of geologic time, because it preserves ancient organisms in a perfect 3D space. It's essentially like it's almost like suspended animation in some ways, because the organisms that are preserved in the amber look like they just died, you know, but yet they're millions of years old.
Of the 5,800 pieces, which are now stored in a literal shipping container, more than 600 of them have inclusions. Some, says microscopist and research assistant Andrew Langendam, even have multiple.
The most exciting ones that we've found are things like the springtails. We've got these long-legged mites called leptis mites. We've also found some little biting midges, so they're tiny little sandflies, essentially, that have been able to, you know, go and fly and suck blood off other creatures. So we've unfortunately had blood-sucking insects for a very long time in Australia. But we also have the social ants. We have a lot of long-legged and short-legged flies. And there's bryophytes and mosses as well, so these really sort of low-order plants. I could keep going on, but I think I'd be here all day.
These most exciting inclusions date from the late Triassic period, around 230 million years ago, to the early Paleogene, around 40 million years ago. One deposit, which is easily the most excited inclusion, was found by a member of the volunteer program that research assistant Dr. Lachlan Sutherland heads up, and is a perfect example of this suspended animation that Associate Professor Stilwell speaks of. The volunteer's name is Pippi, and she knew she'd found something, but didn't know what.
She knew it was something. She could see some legs and wings, and she's like, I think this is something. And I had a look under the microscope, and I was like, yeah, it's a fly. And then sort of looked a bit deeper, and there was a second one hanging on to the first one, and yeah, I got quite a bit excited. It was nice, because this was, you know, almost 2 years into the project, and we found bits and pieces, but this was the first, like, really exciting piece, and we all rushed over to the big camera, and as the images came in, you could see, yeah, these are amazing.
This frozen behaviour is just one of many notable rarities within this huge discovery of amber-entombed arthropods, plants and fungi. A discovery that has seen Associate Professor Stilwell and his team welcomed with open arms by others who are interested in what is regarded as the holy grail in the discipline.
I actually gave the first ever talk on Australian amber last year in the Dominican Republic. And after my talk, colleagues came up to me and gave me a big hug saying, you know, welcome to the global amber paleontology community.
This community of people, says Stilwell, have been yearning for scientists in Australia to find amber. And with the way things are looking, these yearnings will continue to be fulfilled for quite a while longer.
Oh, I'm not going to stop. In fact, we made a big discovery in the amber just about a month ago, which I'm not really allowed to talk about it yet, but let's just say that there's a lot more to come.
Associate Professor Geoffrey Stilwell of Monash University, ending that story by Lachlan McPherson. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can listen to our podcasts. Just search for The Wire, individual stories. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Look for The Wire Radio, all one word. Wire, of course, is a team effort from 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. You can hear us around Australia on your radio, courtesy of the Community Radio Network, or online weekdays. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney and was produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay safe. Thanks for your company.
Sadness in your bones, but you can't say why. Favors for favors, a sword in your side. I wanna play Judas and Jesus Christ. At the same time, there's no end, though it seems so nice. Hear the murder. Birthright.